Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. Stephen Post has spent most of his life researching love, and it's taken him in some pretty incredible directions. For the past 20 years, he's headed up the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love in partnership with Sir John Templeton and the Templeton Foundation. He's also the best-selling author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live a Longer, Happier, Healthier Life by the Simple Act of Giving, and most recently, God and Love on Route 80, The Hidden Mystery of Human Connectedness. Currently, he's at Stony Brook University, where he directs the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics. Our conversation is as far-reaching as Post's multifaceted career. From noticing the uncanny synchronicities of life, to seeing the soul of people with dementia, those he calls the deeply forgetful, to his latest research on raising kind children and creating communities of care, Post is a wise and thoughtful voice at the intersection of science and spirituality. This concept that you've spent your life in a medical establishments, scientific communities, at colleges, prestigious colleges throughout the country, mm-hmm. and yet you're tasked with studying love. Yeah. And one of the, I pulled out from your book, one of your medical directors said, we're okay with words like kindness around here, but unlimited love is a little bit over the top. So your institute is called the
Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, named by Sir John Templeton personally.
Personally.
And you, he selected me to be the president.
And you tried, even with Sir John, to push back and offer him a more softball secular term.
So I was at Case Western Medical School, and I was surrounded by a lot of people. I had a genetics grant for Alzheimer's disease, and I was, you know, respectable. He had sent me a fax that said, Stephen, why don't we start an institute to study the greatest asset of human experience? And it's not just human love, but it's divine love and how we connect with that spiritually and how we're able to do remarkable things and really feel transformed. He was very interested in spiritual transformation. So I faxed back, Sir John, what should we call that? He said, let's use the greatest methods of science that we can, and we'll call it the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love. And I admit that even I had a little moment of pause. So I faxed back, Sir John, maybe we should consider calling it the Institute for Creative Altruism, because in biology and social science, altruism is kind of an acceptable term. And he faxed back. He said, no, I think unlimited love up to $8.9 million. And I faxed back, Sir John, I love that language. It jumps right off the page. He was completely correct, because he wanted this to really be at the interface of science and spirituality at the deepest levels. He didn't want to sort of deflect from that.
In some ways, you've said how you wrote this book. Obviously, this story has been part of you, a guiding force throughout your whole life. Mm-hmm. And you've dripped it out in little bits and pieces throughout your career. But it took until now, in this stage in your life, to actually put it together. I wonder, did you have to build up the muscle to sort of endure?
Well, you know, there are realities about a scientific culture that is primarily based on a materialist metaphysics. Sir John wanted really to study spirituality at its most profound levels. And he wasn't interested merely in human emotion, in human kindness, although those were important things, and he cared a lot about how to raise a kind child as a parent and so forth. But, you know, in the end of the day, he was extremely interested in how we experience divine love in these incredibly creative, mystical type moments, and how that transforms our lives. And he thought that divine love was, you know, perfectly wise, perfectly universal, perfectly intensive, perfectly enduring. And human love, you know, he had lots of doubts about it, because sometimes it reverses and turns into hatred. It's myopic. It kind of flutters in and out like a light bulb. So he was interested in the absolute depth of our experiences when we really feel that incredible divine energy.
And you know, I have a quote that you wrote that I thought typifies what you're saying beautifully. Human love is interesting, but only as a flawed and imperfect reflection of unlimited love, which is the ultimate reality. Humans didn't invent love. It was there at the beginning, before the universe, with its time and space, came into existence. So it was there at the beginning. That's courageous. Our hope for humanity comes when we can awaken our ability to tap into the infinite spirit, which is just in us as it is in the orderly elegance of the universe. So in Sir John's view, and I think yours, the physics and math were windows into the divine.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sir John, and many physicists nowadays, not so much the biologists or the social scientists, but many physicists, you know, written books, The Mind of God, Paul Davies, and so forth, and they see this divine intent and infinite mind underlying the thermodynamic constants of the universe, mathematical principles. And in today's world, Larry Dossey is fabulous. I mean, he wrote a book called One Mind. And he said, you know, how do we really explain these experiences of premonition, intuition, dream, mm-hmm. that really, you know, come into reality, and they're totally beyond what is materially possible,
right?
So if my mom is 3,000 miles, like when I was up in Oregon, and I was in this incredibly dangerous motorcycle ride, I thought I was finished. I was really weeping because it was slippery. It was late January, and I was completely crazy to be on that motorcycle with Andy, who was it turns out a pretty drugged up person, going 180 miles an hour on the Pacific Coast Highway. I really thought I was dead. And somehow he came back and he dropped me off exactly where he picked me up in front of the coffee house at Reed. I staggered across a ravine to my dorm. I never answered the phone. There was a payphone on the wall. It rang. I felt sort of pushed toward it. And believe it or not, it was my mother. And she said, I woke up, I had this incredible premonition, I was sweating, and I feared that you were dead. So I told her, Mom, I'm not dead, but I was almost dead, and we talked about it. And we actually connected at that point. She had a little bit of a mystical quality. She was an artist.
And you write in your book about the love of a mother uniquely. You know, and I'm thinking of this concept of love. You know, in many of our Judeo-Christian traditions, we have only masculine images of God. And yet that seems to be, you seem to be calling us to a maternal, a mother quality to the divine, which I think is really missing in our culture.
Yeah, very much so. You know, moms have a special love. Now, you know, I have two kids who are growing up, and obviously, you know, I was invested as a dad. There's something really unique about the relationship between a mother and a child. It really is, I believe, at its best, the highest form of human love. Now, it can be distorted. It can, in some cases, be abusive. And you can even have people paying off coaches at Ivy League universities to get their 18-year-old kids into college, which is not good parenting, you know. Like I say, human love is flawed, but the best thing we have in human experience, I think, is motherly love, and I take it very seriously. So I think it's not uninteresting that when people report these premonitional experiences, and a lot of people do, you know, it's usually the mother who has this incredible intuition about her son or daughter who's on the battlefields in World War I. And I mean, the literature on this is replete and full and ample. So there's something going on there about the depth and the purity mm-hmm. Of a mother's love that I think somehow moves them into the zone of pure unlimited love, as Sir John would refer to the love of the infinite mind.
And you know, you talked about how since your book has come out, it's unleashed a conversation. It's unleashed a torrent of people wanting. You've given people permission to share these moments that we know are there's something bigger than ourselves, but because it's, you know, not acceptable, not in vogue, intelligent, rational people don't have these conversations. And you're sort of breaking that down, that division between sort of reason on one side and divine mystical experiences on the other side. And there's a hunger to do that. We want to talk about this. This is the richness of our human birthright.
I wanted to free people. That's why I wrote the book. You know, I didn't have to write this. I'm a tenured professor in a great med school, but I also know that when I talk with people, and over the years I've mentioned these little stories here and there, you know, it always brings them to life. And people will say, you know, I had a similar experience, and it's really astonishing, and it's hard to explain it. You know, how do you explain the fact that my mom called me just at that moment in Oregon? It's very, if you just do it in those sort of statistical terms, it's a real stretch. So it becomes much more rational, I think, to say, you know, there's something called non-local mind, which Jung believed in, which all, you know, physicists like Bohm, certainly Einstein believed in this kind of a thing, that there's something mysterious about the mind. And in all the great traditions, you know, in the beginning was the word. In the beginning was mind, beyond time and space. That's certainly the Hindu tradition, but it's all these traditions. And the quality of that mind is loving intentionality. And so the universe comes into being through a big bang because that infinite mind of pure unlimited love, to use Sir John's language, wants to share that experience with free agents who can also act purposefully in love. And we also have a small drop of that infinite mind within us in the form of a soul. So I've never given up on the idea of the eternal soul. And I was even in Bangalore, India 5 years ago doing a plenary for a conference on Alzheimer's disease, which was great. All sorts of Hindu neurologists and philosophers, but people from all over the world. And I told them, I said, look, when I encounter somebody who is deeply forgetful with dementia, I use that term, the deeply forgetful, because it's more respectful. I say, you know, I never, ever assume that they're gone, absent, a shell, a husk, dead, or whatever. I know that the communication system is impaired, but underneath that, I believe there is still a full human soul. And the Music in Memory program, which is spreading around the country, shows that if you use personalized music from earlier in a person's life, they will oftentimes come sort of back into themselves for a period of time. So I'm a complete believer in the idea that nothing can separate us from the love of God, not even dementia, not any condition at all, that underneath the chaos, there is still a human soul, and we can connect with it, we can learn to connect with it, and if we notice it, we have to be careful to notice these things. Larry Dossey uses the word noticer, be a noticer of the things around you, including these synchronicity encounters.
You talk about your grandmother who you lost to Alzheimer's, and that you as a young person saw something beyond in her eyes. I want to talk about, because you take it to the next level and you connect our devaluation of the deeply forgetful to our sort of Western affliction of valuing money and production. Again, it gets back to reason and the enlightenment. Yes. I think, therefore I am. I love you wrote. You argue that I feel and I relate and still I am. Not quite, it doesn't roll off the tongue as much as I think, therefore I am. But you're calling us to something beyond reason and these hypercognitive values.
Absolutely. I coined the term hypercognitive values, and there have now been conferences in Europe and Australia about the problem of hypercognitive values. Look, I mean, the Enlightenment philosophers in the West, Locke and Kant and so forth, they said, well, you're really only a person if you can lay out rational plans and operationalize them in the future. But, you know, people who are deeply forgetful, well, they can't do that. You know, they can't lay out plans and sort of have agency in that very rational sense. But, you know, they can relate to a symbolic object. They can know who they are. You can give them cues and remind them with an article of clothing. The great artist de Kooning, you know, he had Alzheimer's for 14 years. He was diagnosed at Cornell Hospital. And, you know, for 13 of those years, he painted. He was in an apartment in Greenwich Village, and he would just sporadically rise up. He had an assistant, and he would just paint. And so even though he was compromised in lots of ways, he still knew who he was. He still related to himself as an artist. He liked to wear the dungarees of a painter. And it's amazing that for 13 out of 14 years, you know, he was still de Kooning the artist. And when they did a posthumous exhibit of his work in New York, one reviewer said, oh, this is a mockery of the great de Kooning, the artist of anxiety. But a really good reviewer in the New Yorker said, wait a minute, this was a guy who had dementia, and he painted his way through it, and his painting actually became more serene, more tranquil, more spiritual, and he kind of put aside that crazy modernity. So I always think that there's something we can learn from deeply forgetful people about how not to just be running past each other all the time, you know, running from point A to point B, but sort of stopping. Also, they talk about living in the now, right? So when you're around someone who's deeply forgetful, because they've lost a lot of that temporal glue between past, present, and future, it's really great because the only way you can connect with them is in the now.
You know, and your muse was folks that are deeply forgetful, but it translates to, as we talked about at the beginning, those that have disabilities, the elderly, even children. You know, anyone who doesn't have economic value, you know, we push to the side. We don't honor. We say we do, but you know, our value. We live as if we don't, and we just how much we're enriched by living amongst each other, not segregating off to whether it's Florida, retirement community, or institution, which, of course, that's a very complicated issue when you, sometimes parents do need support. And
It's good to have three generational households.
Yeah.
And architecture that supports that. Like
absolutely.
The Victorian homes, you know, there was always a place for grandma and grandpa. And now, you know, your house doesn't have that much room. It's kind of a car pod. Mm-hmm. Grandma and grandpa are in some nursing home where they've gone down to North Carolina. And so there's no interaction going on. And that's bad for the kids because the kids are getting their latest wisdom, you know, from the video games or the software. And you don't have that intergenerational flow from the older adults down the generational chain. So they're not passing the torch. And that's a real obstacle in terms of helping young people develop their capacity for kindness and forgiveness and learning basic values. Not to mention, you know, please, you're welcome, and thank you, right? So that intergenerational flow is really important. And that's where older adults find their purpose in almost all cultures around the world. And they're revered, right? But we have this kind of cult of youth, and we shove these folks off because they're not economically productive. And it's been very damaging.
you know, I want to talk about your work in light of community. You know, I think right now we're in this time of massive kind of social and cultural and environmental breakdown. And it feels very scary, even though there's a thread of hope, you know, and pushing us towards greater justice and equality for racial and gender issues. But there's also this like huge feeling of destruction because it's breaking down faster than it's building up. And of course, it is actual destruction with, you know, the fires burning in the Amazon. And I look at our changing social patterns and how we have less folks involved in organized religion, mm-hmm. but more folks believing in spirituality. We see maybe not the Rotary Club, but an old sort of civic organizations of yore, but we have newer intergenerational housing or community gardens. There's all this kind of fresh opportunity for creation that the younger generations are really, I think, have a lot of wisdom out. And we don't, it doesn't have a name yet. It's kind of this new movement, this new creation. And so I think about your legacy and your career and your life's work. And I think about this kind of really moment of creativity and this moment, you know, you've written a lot about giving and volunteerism and the helper's high. How do you hold together? Because I think naming it as a creative opportunity gives a lot of, it's important to really to focus on that this is a really generative time, and that those of us that are working towards generating this, we feel sort of isolated and alone in these pockets. But there really is a great shift happening here. How would you talk about that in light of your work?
Well, the light always comes out of the shadows, and we are living at a time of transition. I am very optimistic, not in a superficial way, about the future. Take the medical students. You know, I've been teaching in medical schools for a long, long time, 35 years, Chicago, Ann Arbor, Case for 20 years, Stony Brook. The medical students now are more generous, more compassionate, more committed, more idealistic. And you know, they're not getting paid what they used to get paid. Their parents sometimes are saying, don't go into medicine, Susie or Johnny, go to Wall Street. But they're unbelievably creative. They're so magnificently philanthropic that they dream up things that you couldn't even believe. But I understand spirituality, and that people more and more have this sense of a oneness, of a universal mind. I use the word in my book, infinite mind, for a whole number of reasons. But I do believe that people are increasingly becoming more spiritually attuned, and that's with their own inner being, with their neighbor, with all humanity. When I was at St. Paul's, actually, Norman Rockwell came down from Stockbridge, Massachusetts to Concord, and actually came up, because you know, he came up to Concord from Stockbridge, and he actually gave a talk on his iconic image of the positive golden rule, do unto others. This was 1967 when he gave that talk, but he painted that in 1961, I believe. Before the Civil Rights era, he injected it into American culture on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, I believe. And, you know, it's got people from every age, every color, every religion, the secular existentialist rubbing his chin in the middle. There are no boundaries to the image, so it has the feeling of a shared humanity. And they're all just focusing their minds meditatively on this idea, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's not the negative version, don't do unto others. That just means if I don't elbow you in the back today, I can go home and feel pretty good about my life. That's not requiring much. But it's really powerful. And all these people are meditating on this. They're thinking, how can I contribute to the lives of others? And if you look at their faces, there's an incredible tranquility and a peacefulness about them. And so, you know, now we know, when I got to Stony Brook, I had a call from United Health, which is a managed care system. And they wanted to have a national survey of adult Americans which actually occurred in early 2010. So they surveyed 5,000 Americans, adults from all over the country. It was a random survey. Did you volunteer in 2009? 41% had. How much? Not a lot, just 100 hours a year. So break it down, maybe a couple of hours a week. But then how did you feel? 68% made me feel physically healthier. 90% made me feel happier. 80% made me able to deal with loss and disappointments more easily. 90% gave me a greater sense of purpose and meaning in life. All these studies are incredible. Made me sleep better. Deeper friendships. My friends just aren't the people I party with, but they share my values and they kind of keep us on track. And so it's an incredible study about how much we get as givers. So I got a call to do a plenary address in Manhattan. So the guy in the back of this room was actually the Marriott in the middle of Midtown. And he's frantically waving his hands. And so I called on him, yes, sir. And he said, I don't care what you say, buddy. I don't do nothing for nothing. And I thought to him, you know, all I'm talking about is the internal benefits of this, that it's better to feel those benefits, even if you're not getting tit for tat, if you're not getting payback, if you can't calculate that. It's just put that on the shelf, because the inner benefits that you'll feel through this helper's high and all these experiences, it's so much better than going into that negative vortex of despair and rumination and hostility and bitterness that, you know, ramp up your cortisol levels and cause a lot of physical damage and psychological damage. So just do it for yourself.
And that, I think that's a really important message, that positive feedback loop. Because everyone I know wants to give back, especially I'm at the age where we're raising kids. Everyone wants to model for their children, but to add volunteerism as one more thing on top of a very full plate that modern families have. Yeah. But you know, I think this point that it's not to help others necessarily, it's to help, or it's both. It's both. It's a positive feedback loop that helps ourselves just as much as it helps others. And that's not in the common sort of, that's not common knowledge, and I think it's so important.
It's really important, and you know, all the great spiritual traditions say that in the giving of self lies the unsought discovery of a deeper self. You're not necessarily even thinking that you're going to benefit, but as a byproduct, a side effect, even unintended, you'll generally, not always, but generally people will find that they find greater purpose and meaning and joy in life and community. So raising a kind child, you know, it's really key. And there's a lot of research being done on this now. It's so important. Now, this Harvard study from the education school there says, a national study over the last 2 years, parents emphasize kindness with their kids until about age 12 or 13. And then it's all getting ahead, competition, and so forth. So that kind of gets lost, which is a real problem. And there are three secrets to raising a kind child, which are very well demonstrated. The first one is volunteer together. So find some project in your community that floats your boat as a family and do it together intergenerationally. That's really important. And debrief about it. The other thing is have a family credo that you have to make up yourself. Honesty, kindness, love, key values, even if there are just five or six of them, that's all you need, and then tack it up on your refrigerator. And it becomes the sort of cultural center of value for your home. So when there's a difficulty, you can bring everyone together, including your 7 or 8 year old kid, you know, and you have that there. And research shows that it's incredibly powerful. And the other thing is, you know, when your kids hit that age of 13, 14, 15, don't abandon kindness. Still make it the core value that you're looking for in their lives, and acknowledge it, reward it, support it, role model it is very important.
I want to talk about the rewiring of generations. I believe in sort of taking your work and applying it to modern family life. The sense, I think you say in your book, it's no measure of health to be well-adjusted in a profoundly sick society.
Yeah, quoting...
you quoted a Hindu sage. Hindu sage you said. Yeah. But, you know, so much of us are relearning patterns that we were raised with. My generation, the generation before mine, I know did this, and I'm sure the generation after us will. Especially like sort of these authoritarian, you talked about your dad being a really stern Navy captain, and not to pick on your dad, but you know, these like old ways. There's a sociologist who calls it transformation of intimacy, where you're unlearning how to love and relearning how to love. And this is, again, really deep, really courageous work to break patterns of trauma, to break patterns of just harm, to heal the next generation. And I, again, it's one of those things that I think so many of us are doing. We don't really name and we don't really talk about how this is happening on a collective. Celebrate it, encourage it. And I don't know, how else can we support it? What in your work, does that resonate with you? Do you see this happening on a broad collective scale, this kind of rewiring and transformation?
Yes, but it has to be intentional.
Yeah.
Now, you know, in the medical school I work at, we make tremendous efforts to build communities of trust. We actually use the language of a Philadelphian named Parker Palmer, circles of trust. So we have reflection rounds for faculty, small groups of six or seven with a reasonably skilled facilitator, and just let people talk about the human experience of their clinical lives, the things that have frustrated them. Just let people know that we care a lot about their feelings. We know they're struggling with burnout and all kinds of fatigue issues. So the students, the faculty, the clinicians, all of them from different professions, we have these incredible rounds where they're just talking not about patients, not about the illness, not about anything other than their experiences as human beings. When you can create that sort of community and that kind of dialogue and that sort of trust, then it becomes possible to have more compassionate care in a hospital setting. So the center I run is the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care and Bioethics. It's not just bioethics. Do you use a feeding pig in a 90-year-old with advanced dementia? Probably not. That's a quandary. But the more important thing is building a community of character and care that allows then these individuals to have more resilience, to create and galvanize a commitment to compassionate care for patients, and it really works. So we have to create communities with our kids, with our families, that really emphasize certain kinds of behaviors. And if we can do that, it'll work. And by the way, educationally speaking, and there's no question about this, I could rattle off 100 studies. Young people who have some nobility of purpose, you know, they want to learn to, because they want to use their talents to contribute to humanity in certain ways that they'll identify, they get better grades, they're happier in school, they're more resilient, they're better off emotionally, they're less likely to use drugs and alcohol. So if people have a sense of purpose, it's tremendously important. They'll learn more than they will if they're just trying to learn for me, myself, and I. Mm-hmm. It's the same with medical students. You know, the ones who really shine are the ones who have this passion. They're passionaries about people with autism or Alzheimer's, or they really have a feeling in psycho-oncology, and they work beautifully with those patients. I mean, they have some special passion, and that's what brings out their learning and their ability to really do well on national exams and get into good residencies, and even become, if you look at the statistics, it's these individuals with a higher sense of purpose who are the ones who were selected to become chief residents in hospitals around the country.
Again, the virtuous cycle where it's, you know, what's good for you is also good for the collective in these ways.
But I'm completely optimistic, I mean, in a real way. I mean, I guess I say that I'm hopeful. And so I'm absolutely convinced in a hopeful way that that we're turning the corner. I think wonderful things are going to happen. And in the next 20 or 30 years or less, we're going to get to a point where we really have a new level of spiritual depth and sophistication and love worldwide, across all groups. We'll have a deep sense of a shared humanity. We're going to bring that wonderful image of Rockwell to life. And that's where we have to go, because honestly, we don't have much of a choice.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Stephen Post. To read some of the more than 4,000 newspaper and magazine articles he's been quoted in, or to find more about his books or research, visit unlimitedloveinstitute.com. Links to everything can be found at our website, 3MinuteStoryteller.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us. And follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at 3 Minute Storyteller. That's the number 3 Minute Storyteller. Thank you.